Hi, today is July 2nd, 2022. I'm Todd Agosawara and John Westfall. The good doctor's on a secret mission again this weekend. But in his place, we have a Hawaii Techies Edition number 3, and my guest co-host is my longtime friend, the good Dr. Kim Bridges. Actually, Dr. Kent Bridges, but everybody calls him Kim. He is a retired professor of botany from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. I've known him for, over 40 years now, 2022. Yeah, I think it's over 40 years now. We've known each other a long time. I was not a botany student, but nevertheless, I invaded his lab as a young adult and just sort of planted myself there to learn stuff from him. And it is with great pleasure that we were able to do a podcast more than 40 years later to talk about some of the things we remember, some things we're doing now. And he continues to do very interesting things. In fact, Kim, I don't know if I ever told you this story, but when I met you and Stephen Itoga and Arnold Kishi, 40-something years ago, I was 22 years old or something like that. And I remember looking at you guys, and, you guys were in your 30s at the time, I think. And I remember looking at you and going, wow, these old folks. they're really old, but they're still really engaged in what they're doing. And I'm really respectful and admire that a lot. And I hope I'm like them when I'm old and in my 30s. So that was my initial impression of you and the cadre of people I met at that time many, many years ago.
Well, Todd, thanks for the intro. And maybe I can tell a story about you.
Sure.
That having you around the lab was a really good experience. And one of the things you taught me, and I really didn't agree with you, but I think you won in the long run, is about open source software, that you were going around saying, this is the future. And I said, no, big corporations can afford to do it right. That open source stuff will never last. Todd, you're going down the wrong track. But you've proven me wrong, at least in my own work. I've been using open source stuff a lot, and I appreciate your putting me perhaps correct. But the other thing that you did was an event in the lab. And I don't know about you, but there's times that we have where we remember the event because it was so important. For me, when I heard the announcement that Kennedy had been assassinated, sure, I remember exactly where I was.
Sure. I do too. I'm old enough to remember that too, by the way.
Yeah. Well, so we had an event together that has a lasting impression, enough so that I could remember where I was standing in my lab. And that's when we had an administrator come to the lab. He wandered in and we were talking, and he made the point that he only liked problems that were easy problems. Mm. He didn't like hard problems. Well, he left soon after that. And I remember we both had a sense of outrage. You were particularly upset. And you said, as I remember it, the only good problems are the hard problems. And that stuck with me, that I think that we're committed, if we really want to advance things, taking on the hard problems. That easy problems anybody can do, but there's some of us that I think have to dedicate ourselves to going after the hard ones. And so I think back at, what are those hard problems we've tried to solve? And I think we can find them, and we have to often evaluate them. Did we do the right thing? Did this make a difference?
Yeah. And, the odd thing is some of the problems that we've had to solve or resolve over the decades, we didn't actually think of as problems back then. It's just the way it was. And as time went on, it says, nah, this isn't it.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. But sometimes we jump on a problem and say, let's see if we can do something. And one thing that you did that I do remember is you took a picture of me. Mm-hmm. One day when I was on my Segway.
Yes.
And the reason that sticks in my mind, again, I remember exactly where it was, is nobody had ever taken a picture of me on my Segway. A lot of people had seen me on a Segway. But the brief story is that my partner Nancy and I were in Paris, and we rode Segways when they first came out around Paris one evening in the rain on a tour. And I said, this is really interesting. We should try this seriously. Mm-hmm. And when I came back to Hawaii, I found a used Segway that I could buy. I got rid of my car, and I said, I'm going to ride this as my sole form of transportation for 3 years, whether it works or not. And so I rode it from downtown to campus every day, and I found that I could get there as fast as I could with a car, because I didn't have to walk from a parking lot.
Right. And also, we have terrible traffic.
Yeah, terrible traffic. And I didn't have to pay the parking lot fees, which were high. So pretty soon I had covered the cost of the Segway. And the bad weather, which we often have in the morning, that is a lot of rain. I just got good rain gear. And as I went on the highway getting splashed by cars and rained on, I was having more fun than anybody else. That it's great to get splashed when you don't actually get wet. So I was the kid on the sidewalk on the Segway having a great time. And it lasted not for 3 years, but over 5 years. I rode that until I retired, and I've put over 5,000 miles on the Segway.
Wow. You know, I got to tell you, your Segway was the first Segway I ever saw in person. And yeah, that's true. I've never seen it. I've only seen pictures of it. And it was, I was so impressed. I had to bring my then young daughter with me to see what it looked like. And I don't, she was actually pretty interested in it, but yeah. I think she was like 7 or 8. I said, this is a Segway. And you kind of rode around in it, and she was fascinated. So we both saw the Segway for the, a real Segway for the first time, more or less together.
Well, I think that experiment might be validated now with all of the micro-mobility experiments that are going on in towns. Now, they're not using Segways, but they're using scooters, which are kind of a derivative or the opposite.
Yeah.
Anyhow, people laughed at me in those days, but I was having a lot of fun and saving a lot of money, and it worked for me.
I thought it was pretty cool myself. And by the way, downtown these days... In the year since I saw you on a Segway, I have seen a guy on a motorized unicycle downtown. I mean, and several times, not just once. Rolling down King Street from west to east. I don't know if that matters, but that's what I saw. Oh, well, that's a traffic fault, so that doesn't matter. He would be going against traffic if you're going east to west. But I have seen one person, I think, at a building near me on a motorized skateboard. It's about... Mm-hmm. 4 feet long, and it's got a motor on it, and he's got like a remote control in his hand, and that's how he steers. There's no there's no steering pole. It's all some kind of radio frequency control. So that's kind of fascinating. And of course, tons and tons of electric bikes.
Yeah, electric bikes are a big thing. And in New York City recently, we saw lots of delivery people on electric bikes. That seems to have transformed the delivery system.
Yeah. In fact, I should note that my regular co-host, John Westfall, who's a professor at Delta State University, he recently bought an electric bike maybe 6 months ago, and that's how he gets around. He lives near a campus, and so he really doesn't need a car. He used to walk, and he still does, but he bought an electric bike for other kinds of mobility things, and he's really enjoying it. He's tricked it out at all kinds of accessories you can buy for this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one of the things that happened just this past week on June 29th is the iPhone turned 15. And 15 is based on the release date, not the announcement date, which is, I think, in January of 2007. But it was released June 29th, 2007. It's been 15 years. And I know you have been, I think you've been an Android user for, well, not all of that time, because Android didn't come out until 14 years ago. So are you still mostly an Android phone user?
Yeah, I'm a really committed Android phone user. I tend to do the every other mm-hmm. model upgrades.
Yep.
In about December, we both, Nancy and I both upgraded to the Pixel 6 Pro.
Oh, nice.
And so we're using those. And in fact, we did a test on this. We spent a month in Washington, D.C. earlier in the year. And we wanted to catch the cherry blossoms.
Mm-hmm.
And so I only took my cell phone for my camera. And I was very pleased the way it worked out. It wasn't perfect, but I think that was one of the nice upgrades. And I was really pleased with how that's been developing.
Excuse me. Yeah, I have both an Android and an iPhone. I have a 4, a Pixel 4a, which is aging, but I'll tell you why I still have it and I haven't replaced it on schedule. Is as far as I can figure, and because I am a cheapskate, the Pixel 4a is the last Google Pixel camera or big Pixel phone that is permitted to or is grandfathered in to have unlimited Google Photo storage. So, anything I upload from the 4a is still free of storage charge versus any other newer Pixel phone. So, I'm kind of reluctant to let it go.
Speaking of picture storage, Todd, that I take a few pictures now and
Oh,
then.
yeah.
So I shifted my storage over to a QNAP network attached storage
Oh,
device.
yeah, nice.
And that's been going very well for a few years. But like all good RAID boxes, I lost a disk about a year ago.
Sure.
And then I discovered that, well, that was a good wake-up call. That in fact, having a failure like that was something I needed. I didn't actually lose anything because not only did the RAID protect me, but I back it up. But I was running out of space, so I have upgraded. So I have 39 terabytes of storage, which sounds like a lot, but with today's cameras, you pile up photos and a lot of gigabytes really fast.
Yeah, and you probably shoot all, well, not on your phone, but for your regular camera, you probably shoot RAW too. So they're huge files, right? Not that just usual JPEGs.
Right. So recently, my primary camera has been the Sony 7R4, which is 63 megapixels. And so, yeah, you get big pictures with RAW.
And I think you mentioned before the podcast that you are upgrading that, right?
Yeah, well, I think for the kind of photography I do, it's good having a backup camera. So I got the Sony Alpha 1, which is a 50 megapixel. But the nice thing about that camera is it has the bird eye focus. You can actually see the AI activities in the camera. That is, it really locks up, it recognizes birds and finds the eye. And for birds that move fast, it's an essential capability on a camera.
I had never thought of that, but I understand it. As soon as you mentioned it to me, I said, yeah, that makes so much sense. I just never thought of it.
So often the birds that I want to take photos of are hidden in shrubbery and autofocus doesn't work. So you're manually focusing. And for a bird that's moving fast, doing manual focus is nearly impossible. So if I had a yield rate of one good photo out of 100, I thought it would be a good day. With the bird eye focus, my yield rate is about every other picture is a good one.
Oh, that is good, actually.
Yeah.
And I should note, although Kim is a retired professor of botany, my recollection is you also have another degree in zoology. So,
Well, 2 degrees in zoology.
okay, I like to think that helps explain your interest in animals, but anyway, as well as plants, but. Yeah, it's been interesting because from a photography point of view, it's I stopped traveling a couple of years ago just because I hate traveling. I know you and Nancy love traveling as does my wife and daughter, but I myself just do not enjoy it at all. Never have. And I used to carry, well, I shouldn't say when I used to travel, I carried both a phone once phone cameras became reasonable. And a always carried a regular camera, but less. I found myself using a regular camera less and less. And in fact, I think when my daughter and I were in Scotland several years ago, did I even carry a regular camera? I don't even remember. I think I took shot everything on an iPhone or a Pixel or Nexus or whatever I had at the time. And generally speaking, I'm still pretty happy at all the photos. And I think I didn't have a digital camera to GPS at the time. For some reason, GPSs went out of fashion in digital cameras, at least in the low level, you know, the point and shoots that I buy in the $300 to $500 range. And so, you know, I had a GPS LAT launch for all my photos from my phone. And so I was really pretty happy with the quality and the ability to geolocate photos and all of that. And I think that's a fundamental change for me, the iPhone and later the Android phones, is the photo quality has been so good that you always took a lot of photos, but you know, I took photos, but not in the hundreds or thousands like I do now, because it's so easy and, you know, just phone's always with me, whereas my camera wasn't. Although I was carrying a camera, a shoot point and shoot with me in my backpack for years, just even going to work, but I was able to stop that. So
One observation on that, Todd, is when I carry a camera, I too have a cell phone, mm-hmm. but I don't switch back and forth between them.
Oh.
And one of the things I even learned about the interchangeable lens cameras mm-hmm. is early on, the advice was you should get 5 lenses, and 3 of those should probably be zooms, and then you can cover the entire range of anything you see. You can do a good composition. And I did that, and I think it was a big mistake. that now, without, let me skip over the intermediate steps. Now yeah. I limit myself almost exclusively to 2 lenses for any trip.
Okay.
I ask myself, what is it that I'm going to be doing
right.
that needs pictures? And I take the 2 lenses that are appropriate for that, generally a wide angle. I have a 24 millimeter that I like. Mm-hmm. And if I'm going to do birds, then I have to take a big telephoto, 100, 400. Mm-hmm. But if I'm just doing travel stuff, then I take something like 135 millimeter prime. And I live on those 2 lenses. And on any particular day, I only put 1 lens on. I say, today's a wide angle day, or today's a people day.
Yeah.
And I get into the mindset of, this is the perspective that I want for this particular day. And so at times the cell phone works just fine. And especially with some of the new ones where you have multiple cameras.
Right.
With the new Pixel 6 Pro, I have a nice telephoto. It's about 100 millimeter telephoto. I find that very handy. It's a really good addition. But it says something about you have to kind of get into the situation and exploit the situation rather than being a generalist and saying, I see everything, I'm going to do everything.
Mm.
I sort of narrow my ambitions when I'm out doing photography. As a result, I get things that are much better.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been a big change. And it also makes it lighter. I don't have to carry 5 lenses and run the risk of losing them or having them damaged.
No kidding. I mean, and just the volume of storage for 5 camera lenses, which are not tiny, that probably saves you just suitcase space or...
Yeah, big primes. So yeah. I recently sold off quite a bit of my gear, just simplifying what I do.
Yeah.
And I think the simplification's a good part of the development.
Yeah, and in fact, simplification of gear in general has been a really welcome side effect of the digital transformation over the last decades. You know, we used to, I probably never carried as much stuff as you do in terms of, photography. Well, I know I never carried as much stuff as you do in terms of photography gear. And you were carrying GPSs when most of us couldn't even spell it and things like that. And, going from 6, 7, 8 different devices and power chargers and battery packs down to 1 or 2 has been a real space saver, not even for just traveling, but just wandering around on a daily basis, you know, from home to office or home to anywhere. It's just a much more enjoyable experience to just, you know, have your stuff with you that doesn't require a giant backpack or a suitcase or even worse, a suitcase with, you know, foam protective, to protect the gear.
I might add documents into that list.
Absolutely.
That with PDFs, we're not carrying all that paper.
Yeah.
And that's a big deal.
And I should know that, gosh, when was this? It must have been, it's before my daughter was born, so it must have been over 30 years ago. I remember you brought in a high-speed scanner, and you sawed off the binding of all of your textbooks, of your library, basically. Not textbooks to study, but, well, I mean, textbooks to study, but your library. And you scanned everything in.
Yes, I did that. And it took years because I was busy during the week. So I'd come in on Saturday and spend Saturday scanning stuff, or with that high-speed scanner, put it off in the corner and just let it munch pages. So when I retired, I didn't have a lot of books to bring back to my apartment. I brought practically none. So here's a question for everybody to think about. If you know an academic person in a research situation, you'll know that they have a ton of books.
Yes.
They have literally walls filled with books. And
I did.
Yeah. So when we start these long-term projects, we're worried about some of the implications of, if I scan all of that, will I be able to store it? What's the digital storage cost? My surprise was when I got done with the entire library, and by the way, I did OCR on it so I could do full text searching on everything. I could store the whole library on a small SD card.
Wow. Wow.
Now, think of that. You could slip your entire digital library, that wall of books, into your wallet, and you wouldn't notice it was there.
It is amazing.
That was mind-blowing to me.
Yeah.
As a result, not only do I have the library, I have several backups of it. So if something were to happen, like a flood, I don't lose it.
Yeah. And it's probably, if you can fit an SD card, and since you have so many terabytes in your NAS, you can put it in your NAS, and probably even small enough to put up in the cloud.
It is in the cloud, but it's protected because I'm not sharing it.
Yes.
Copyright says we don't do that.
Right. Right.
Todd, several times you brought up GPS.
Yes.
It just really makes me want to tell you a story that I think I've never told you.
Okay.
So I did field research in the Marshall Islands, and we were invited by the government to go out and do a survey of an atoll that had been impacted by the atomic testing that the U.S. did. And so we went out and did the survey. This wasn't the first time that we had been out there. The previous year, we had done a preliminary reconnaissance at a neighboring atoll that had the landing strip. And I took a GPS out. That's when we had handheld standalone GPSs. And we went out to the tip of that atoll, where there was an entrance to the lagoon. And I thought it would be a great place for a photo location. And so I put in a waypoint, as we did in those days. You find a menu and punch in a couple buttons, and you could locate, you could record the GPS location. So when we went back to do the survey of this other atoll, I just happened to take that one GPS that I had the previous year. It was kind of a random choice since I had four or five similar GPSs. So that went along, and I didn't do something that I should have done. I didn't clear the memory on that GPS. I was too busy. So here we are out in the middle of the Pacific, and we decide that we're going to travel between these two atolls. It's only 12 miles apart, but these are low-lying atolls. So we're in a small boat with outboard motors, and the Marshallese are the best navigators in the Pacific. And so we have great faith, no problems. Off we go between these two atolls. We're into this trip several hours, and the seas are getting rough, and we're getting little rain showers on us. And my colleague says, "Did you bring a GPS?" I said, "Yeah, but it's up front. It's, I really don't want to open up my luggage because it might get wet." He says, "Go get it." So I got it, and I turned it on. Now, we didn't have maps and GPSs in those days. You only had the coordinates.
Right.
So I turned it on, and I realized that I had a waypoint from where we were headed. And so I brought up the waypoint, and I looked and told the guy running the boat, "Turn left 90 degrees. We're off course." And in about a half an hour, we got to the entrance of the lagoon and ran out of fuel.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
Had I not had that GPS...
And forgotten to clear it.
with that waypoint, we would still be out in the ocean.
Oh, my God.
Because nobody was expecting us. There was nobody who would have said, hey, they're overdue. We should go look for them. Nobody was expecting us. And so it's one of about five times in my research career where I consider I had a near-death experience. In this case, I was saved by technology.
Wow. And this is before cell phones? Well, I mean, there were cell phones, but very few people had them.
Well, out there, there was no cell phone coverage,
nobody.
Believe me.
And out in the ocean anyway, right?
This place we were at, the one we were doing the survey, nobody had been there in 50 years.
Wow.
This was radioactive. This is where the fallout from the bombs landed. So
wow.
It was safe for us to be there, but nonetheless, it was very, very remote. So we wouldn't have gotten any help.
Wow.
So sometimes this technology has very nice, beneficial consequences.
Yeah. And, you know, something you said, though, I mean, you know, brings to fore the notion that how much technology has changed. You said, and I remember those days when GPS is, you needed to understand geography and latitude, longitude, and altitude and all that kind of stuff to, you know, read terrain maps and to kind of translate from a lat long to, a, you know, maybe a physical paper map or something, you know, similar to that. Versus today where it's sort of like, you know, we have turn by turn directions and things that were not quite unimaginable 30 years ago, but, you know, it was more science fiction than science fact at the time. In fact, I remember I only tried a turn-by-turn GPS. I didn't own one. It was I had to actually rent it for $10 a day in a Hertz rent-a-car back in, I think, the late 90s, and I thought it was just the best thing since sliced bread.
Yeah, well, I've traveled across the country in the last 10 years, the equivalent of five times round trip, and most of the time by myself. And I couldn't do without the turn-by-turn instructions.
Yeah, they're pretty amazing.
Because with all the traffic, you're whizzing down the freeway, and you need to know ahead of time that you have to get a particular exit.
Right.
So it not only gives you the fine directions, but the global directions.
Right. And they also help you deal with unexpected things like a road closure for, you know, whatever reason, and to reroute you. That's what I found the most useful.
Right. Now, some of us set up our phones so other people can see where we are.
I remember you doing that.
And so on more than one of my trips, Nancy, who was home working, would follow me and be able to get me reservations for the night by anticipating where I might be, which was the positive thing. But the more interesting one was when I would take the wrong turn.
Yeah.
And she would notice, let's see, you're not going where you're supposed to be going. And I could get a phone call saying, are you sure you want to be going there? So if you can imagine being in the middle of America, the continental America, and having somebody from Hawaii giving you a scolding because you're not navigating properly. So technology creeps into our life in many interesting ways.
Oh, well, for me, it's been, you know, practical. Well, at least for my adult life, when I was a child, I'm old enough that really there wasn't much in the way of technology that was accessible to me. But as a young adult, certainly, and as a, you know, old person now, so for in those intervening years, it has literally been my life. As you well know, Kim, I mean, you've known me. Well, let me think. Yeah, you've known me my entire adult life, essentially. So you know where I started from and what I started with. And, you know, you recently surfaced a document that I helped you with in 1984. To show how far back, where we gave some advice on PCs, because there was a PC users group at the University of Hawaii at the time that had bought literally thousands of PC as a group buy, if I recall correctly. I think it was thousands. not hundreds.
That's right. In fact, they loaded up a 747 with boxes of PCs. It filled the plane. And we were the single largest university order at the time.
And reading through it, I found it kind of fascinating because some of the general advice still holds true. You know, how to choose your platform. And it's even more confusing today because there's so many more platforms than there were back then, at least for the kinds of things that we were talking about. And so I found that fascinating. I also found it fascinating that one of the reviewers is the current president of the university.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, that was really interesting. And the other interesting thing I noted is that of all the things we discussed, software and accessories and so forth, the thing I would have least expected to survive into the 21st century in some form were the magazines we recommended.
Yes.
Which are no longer on paper, but still, you know, they're still published in a digital form.
Yeah, so, I think the only software is Microsoft Word was in there somewhere, not as one of the big recommendations.
Yeah.
But it was just sort of a hint somewhere.
Yeah. This is Microsoft Word for DOS for people listening. We're talking before Windows.
Well before. One of the interesting things about that document is the reminder that there was such competition between word processors.
Yes.
There were many different word processors, and they basically weren't compatible.
No, at all.
And there was nothing like a PDF that allowed compatibility at the end.
Or open document format, ODF, nothing like that, no.
Right. And so exchanging documents was really a chore.
Yeah, it was
basically
on paper.
Basically, you could only do it on paper, right. And so collaboration was extremely hard.
Yeah, and I think 84, when did I bring in the VAX? Yeah, so this predated our access to the internet, you know, as a group. And so there wasn't, you know, like a file share we could all use in common or anything like that.
Oh, yeah, this was well before that.
Yeah, so it was a very different time. And, you know, going back to Microsoft, I remember I wanted to buy Microsoft Word, but it was enormously expensive. I mean, all the word processors were. I think the one we ended up using was a couple hundred dollars for, you know, at university discount. And I remember wanting to buy Microsoft Word because it came with a mouse, and I didn't have a mouse. And I wanted to find out what it was like to use a mouse. But I held it off because I was a poor student. And a poor grad student at the time. And I just said, I just bought a PC. I've kind of blown all my money. In fact, I think I had to borrow money from my parents. But, well, actually, they gave it to me. you know, I remember one, I said, that mouse is very interesting. I did find at work, we had some of those old mice from back then. And so I squirreled one away from my office. And I have it somewhere in my office right now that I should go find and take a picture of. But I thought that was interesting. And I remember eventually when I got a job and I bought my first mouse, it needed a special metal gridded pad because it was an early optical mouse, but the optics could not work on an ordinary surface. You had to have this blue and red grid metal plate underneath it for it to work at all. And it worked pretty well, but it just shows you how far we've come with just things we consider ordinary technology these days.
So my history on the mouse, Todd, was I went on a tour as part of the 1989 Fall Joint Computer Conference, I believe it was, in San Francisco.
Oh.
There used to be two conferences a year, and if you were doing anything in tech, you had to go to those conferences, at least one of them. So they had a robotics tour of what now has become Silicon Valley, and we got to one of the labs. And they were showing us the robot. And off to the side, they said, oh, we also have this other thing. We're calling it a mouse. And it was, at the time, the only one. That was the original mouse. We all looked at it and said, clunky box. Wonder what you'd do with that. And went on to look at the rest of the robotics, which, in fact, none of them actually worked. I remember one that was supposed to put shoeboxes on a shelf.
Yeah.
And they fired it up for us to show how it could put a shoebox, pick up a shoebox and put it on a shelf. And it managed to smash every box.
Ouch.
So I think we've come a fair ways since then.
Indeed.
But it's interesting to think back about the fact that some of us have lived through this almost entire evolution.
Yes.
Of some of these technologies.
Yes, absolutely.
But what we've seen, Todd, is the evolution of living in an analog world to living in a digital world.
Yes, yes.
And I'm really excited about being able to push more and more into the digital world.
Absolutely. You know,
transferring my library from analog, those paper books, into digital has made it so much more useful. In fact, the evidence you've just given, this document that you've just referred to,
yeah,
I was able to easily find that because it was digital and on my computer. It took just a moment to find that document. Had it been paper, I would be looking for a filing cabinet and pawing through piles of documents and maybe never finding it.
Although, you know, some people, I had a professor, actually, whose lab was next door to the lab that I was able to use. And he was a professor of behavioral genetics, and I was taking one of his classes. I remember there was something I didn't understand, and so I went next door to go see him and ask him a question. And he said, he kind of looked at me, thought about it for a minute, and says, "Wait a second." In his very large lab, he had a pair of 6 foot long folding tables, side to side, lengthwise. And on this table was stacks. Well, stacks is maybe too much of a word. Paper, a mound of paper, mostly in a Poisson distribution, a normalized Gaussian distribution. So it goes, you know, it's kind of tapered at both ends, and then builds up towards a mound in the middle. And there was no particular order to this paper, but he kind of reached into the pile. It was sort of near, in a normal distribution, it'd be sort of just past the mean. And he yanked out a piece of paper, and it was exactly what I needed to refer to understand the problem I was having. And to this day, I have no idea how he did that.
You're right, Todd. There are a few people who could do that. But it's the old 80-20 rule, isn't it? That for those that could do it, there were a lot that couldn't do it. In fact, everything was lost. And another story about that. I convinced another colleague to build a digital library. And we were both in Thailand on sabbatical, and the chair of the department sent an email out saying, "We can't seem to find a document about a policy. Do any faculty members have a copy of it?" Mm-hmm. And within 5 minutes, this faculty member, and here we are in northern Thailand of all places, he sends a copy back to the chair. And he was the only one who could find it.
Oh, that's funny.
And there he was. Not in his office, and he had easy access to it.
Yeah.
And so I think that you have to sort of think of this 80-20 rule. Maybe we shouldn't depend on being good enough to paw our way through one of those big piles, but we should do something that gets us organized.
I absolutely agree. I mean, I am definitely like my former professor, who had this remarkable skill, amongst other remarkable skills. And you know, when I saw that, I said, man, I got to find a better way to organize stuff because I can't do what he does. I know that for sure. But anyhow, we are coming up on an hour, and I'm not sure if Skype was going to cut us off in 30 seconds. So I'm going to close out MobileView's podcast 413, Techies Edition, with the good Dr. Kent, a.k.a. Kim Bridges, my lifelong friend. He's known me my entire adult life, which is kind of scary to think about. But thanks so much, Kim. It's been great talking to you.
Todd, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, thank you for accepting. Okay, we will talk to you next time when John returns from his super secret